When Bush Telegraph began, much of Australia was in drought. It was actually the beginning of the millennium drought. There was pressure at the time on government to come up with a package to support farming communities, and for years, what was in place was something called exceptional circumstances. Since then, there's been no end of various reviews of drought policy and reincarnation of earlier support measures. So over the course of this program's life, there's just about always been a part of the country somewhere that's in drought. Right now it's Australia's east, particularly Queensland and New South Wales. So today, what does government need to do and what responsibility should farmers take when things go bad, when drought really takes hold? Barry Hughes is from the Gulf Cattlemen's Association. Welcome back to the program, Barry.
Morning, Cameron.
What's it really like when you're in the thick of it?
Well, it's a major contract as a landholder and a livestock manager to handle the impacts of drought, and specifically this drought, because it's come on the back of a number of important issues that need to be discussed to put this drought into perspective, Cameron.
Mm-hmm. What are those?
Well, we've had the major fires right across the Northern Gulf area here in December, January 2012. Millions of acres have got burnt out, and a lot of properties lost the ability to produce an income because of that. Leading into 2013, where the drought started to impact the industry across the north and northwest of Queensland, and we've gone into the 2014 year with no potential there through lack of a rainfall event 2013-14 to take care of that productivity cash flow turnover type, or turnover cash flow, situation that the industry's facing.
So your business was already in a weak position by the time this drought hit. Is that the upshot?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. And if you roll the clock back to 2011, we've seen the ban on livestock going into Indonesia, which certainly exacerbated the whole situation by people not being able to market animals, holding on to more stock than they had fodder for because of that situation. So there's a number of issues. It's a complex issue as a whole, and you can't pigeonhole drought as a one-off situation.
But drought is part of the picture, and drought, when you're in drought, it's something that many farmers, I guess, look to government, state and federal governments, for some kind of support. But Barry, when it's not raining, it hasn't for some time, what is it that really keeps you up at night? What's your biggest worry?
Oh, look, I think the financial pressures that the industry is under. The Gulf Cattlemen's Association done a survey back here in September this year across the northwest beef industry, and the average debt across that industry, based on a herd size of 7,000 head of cattle, was $4.2 million. So there's a massive debt burden creating financial pressure on the industry, and that's causing huge psychological problems right across, and it's keeping a lot of people awake at night, no doubt about it.
Okay, you're hearing here from Barry Hughes. Well, Barry, stay with us. Look, one of our reporters, Marty McCarthy, actually went out to get a better picture of the type of pressure that farming families that are in this situation where it hasn't rained, they're in drought, but on the back of low commodity prices and a heavy debt burden as well, to find out what it was really like for them, what it is really like for them. And just a note, the names of the family here has been changed to protect their privacy.
Kicked off and locked out. The Brooks, not their real name, know this farm near Mergen in southeast Queensland is no longer theirs. It's been 3 months since the family was removed from the property. For Tanya Brooks, coming back today brings back painful memories.
Just the way it was done. It was just like people just turn up. There was removalist trucks, there was police, there was everything. And when they come over the grid and you just see it, it's just shocking. We've tried so hard, and the things that we've done, and it's, for the kids and things like that, and they find it hard coming back here because it was just a terrible, situation we went through on that day, and you just have that bad memories.
The value of the Brooks' property decreased so dramatically in recent years due to drought and floods that their debt was higher than the value of their property. But although it's a situation happening in pockets right across Australia, rural debt is the elephant in the room of the nation's agriculture sector. Farmers are too embarrassed to talk about it. The banks dispute it because acknowledging a rural debt crisis would draw their lending practices into question and push property prices lower. Meanwhile, governments talk it down because if they acknowledge there's a crisis, it means they need to fix it, and that could require billions of dollars.
We're saying at emergency home housing at the moment, we wouldn't know where we'd be. We were so grateful to get this house. I rang this person 2 minutes and I said, don't ask questions. I said, do you have a home that we can come to? They said yes.
Tanya and her husband Lindsay have 4 children. One of them is 16-year-old Kurt.
When they first saw the come, I was in the shed and Dad saw these cars coming, so then we sort of just got in a panic and I didn't really know what to do. So then we just sort of had a moment and then we got our stuff and just got out. Well, you know, I just tried to work my hardest and get everything, like what could go or start and get off the place. And yeah.
What does it mean for you in terms of your future in the agriculture sector after an experience like that? Is it something you want to be a part of?
Well, yeah, I still want to do the farm and stuff, but
it makes it difficult.
Yep.
Tanya's husband, Lindsay, says they owed the bank about $600,000. A perfect storm of drought, floods and poor market conditions was the nail in the coffin.
I couldn't put it down to one particular thing, but looking back now, I'd say that the destruction of floods that caused on us and the recovery period to try and get through that, it was too much. We just couldn't recover from not only one but for two major floods.
When people talk about rural debt, they're reluctant to mention, I suppose, their own failings. Do you acknowledge that there has been a fault on your part as well in perhaps borrowing more than you knew you could pay back?
Not so much, because I made mistakes, there's no doubt about that, and I was in default, I was behind in payments, but it's a combination of things, Marty. I can't nail it down to one particular thing that's caused, you know, this to come on, other than the banks are happy to lend money against the valuation, and then as we find in this circumstance, all of a sudden the valuation is dramatically reduced by half or less, you know.
What about in terms of challenges on the land? You talk about there being the dry conditions, but did you overgraze at all?
For sure, mate. We were pushing the farm harder than we should have been. They're the things you do in the time when you're trying to raise more funds, and we were overstocked. We overgrazed the country. We pushed the farm harder, and in hindsight, it's easy to say we should have made decisions earlier to offload stock. The commodity prices were smashed, and potentially you're giving up your livelihood and no potential to get back into it again. You're cutting your own wrists, you know. So, yeah, we were guilty of hanging on too long, for sure, for sure.
The banks and both levels of government are reluctant to admit that there is a rural debt crisis. Do you think there's one?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I said there's a huge rural debt crisis in this country, and mate, I'm sure it's going to get much, much worse, because I said it's had some rain as we speak at the moment. Mate, it doesn't rain money. These stock, for instance, are in droughted condition, and all of a sudden they're not worth a lot of money in the next 24 to 48 hours. It simply takes time, and your debt keeps on accumulating.
Queensland grain and cattle producer Lindsay speaking there to our reporter Marty McCarthy. We've changed the identity of the family for privacy reasons. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. Earlier we were hearing from Barry Hughes from the Gulf Cattlemen's Association. We're discussing who should pay when things go bad for Australia's farmers. Often that's associated with drought, but as you've heard in that story then, there's a lot of factors that can be come into play there. Well, Mick Keogh is the Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute. Nice to have you back on the program, Mick.
Thank you.
The story we just heard there, the Queensland situation, how widespread is that around Australia at the moment?
Well, based on the available data, it's not as widespread as some might think. Certainly the levels of rural debt in Australia have increased, and they increased fairly strongly over the last decade from about 2000. But it's interesting when you compare them with debt levels in the wider community, there's a similar trend. And mostly there's certainly issues around the Northern Australian cattle industry, and to some degree parts of the grains industry. But if you look at debt rural debt in Australia since 2010 is actually stabilised or marginally decreased. So I think we need to be pretty careful about sort of highly emotive claims about a so-called debt crisis. And sure, we're all coloured by our own experience and what we see around us. And I guess if you're sitting in the middle of a very dry part of Queensland, it certainly looks like a debt crisis. But when you look at the rest of rural Australia and the overall numbers, that's not a universal situation. I think we just need to be a bit careful about that. Mm.
But Mick, how do you go about separating the struggles people are facing due to drought at the moment in Queensland, New South Wales, from the struggles they may be in due to their debt problems?
Yeah, and look, that's always been a difficult issue. And I mean, it's interesting when you go back over the history of drought policy from the 70s to 92, drought was included as part of the national disaster arrangement. So every time it was declared, there was quite substantial support measures available. But what happened during that period was governments, and in particular the Queensland government, tended to declare droughts at the drop of a hat, because that basically meant that the Commonwealth had to stump up a substantial proportion of whatever funding was made available. That changed in 92. We've tried measures since then, which included the exceptional circumstances policy. And if we look through that millennium drought from 2003 to 2009, despite a lot of money going out in drought support, in 70% of potentially eligible farmers didn't receive any support at all. They managed it. So,
Your better farmers that didn't get support?
Well, whatever. I don't know that we've got data to be clear on that. But irrespective of what that answer is, the issue is that 70% of farm businesses managed their way through that terrible period on their own. And, you know, so I think the question and the other point that emerged from that is some of the recipients of drought support during that period were repeat recipients, and a lot of them are in the regions now that are in drought again. So I'm not sure that those policies and those measures actually helped to create a more resilient farm business sector that was able to withstand some of those types of challenges. So
do we actually have a government response that keeps people in this cycle of struggling to get from one drought to the next, almost limping from one to the next?
Well, that's a bit of the difficult situation, that certainly there's an argument that what's happening with some of these measures is it's actually keeping people in farm businesses when they shouldn't, when in fact it would be better if they took an option to leave and found something, you know, a bit better to do rather than to face the continual struggle. Now, farming's a lifestyle as much as it is a business, and I guess we're all humans, and that's a difficult thing to face. But certainly the current measures implemented in the last 2 years and after the Western Australian drought pilot have addressed the welfare issues, and I think that's quite important. So the farm household allowance that's now available basically means that someone in a family facing a lack of income due to drought has the equivalent access to things like Centrelink that is available to anyone living in the city or anywhere else.
Okay, but that's different than farm business support, isn't it? You're talking about a safety net for families there.
So the safety net, the welfare net, I think that's been quite a major advance, and I don't think anyone disagrees with that being a quite important part, because often a lot of the stress and the strain and the decision-making processes that have to be made are coloured by the fact that, you know, if you can't put food on the table next week for the kids, or can't pay their school fees, that's a terrible situation. So if you can take that away with at least some welfare support, that allows a little bit more clear thinking around the business side of things, and I think that's been quite an important development.
Mick Keogh is the Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute. Also with me is John Daly, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Grattan Institute. John, you've been listening to Mick and also the farmers earlier. Let's separate the welfare, if you like, the family support, the social support from the business support. What level, if any, of government support should there be for the farm business?
We'd suggest for the farm business there really shouldn't be any at all. If you look at the Productivity Commission, which did a detailed report in this, came out in 2009, they looked at exactly this issue about, well, what were the farms like that were in drought-declared areas but which didn't apply for assistance? And the answer was very clearly they were the farms that had lower levels of debt, that had higher revenues per whatever you look at, and that had higher margins, and that were essentially a lot more profitable. So essentially, even in the worst drought-affected areas, and this is even in 2009, at the at the end of that long and very severe drought, there were farms that were still profitable, still not requiring assistance. And I think that the way that you can think about this is we don't have a fish and chip shop business support scheme. We accept that some fish and chip shops will be really profitable, and that's fantastic, and some fish and chip shops will borrow money. For whatever reason, the business won't make any money. We don't expect that government will then come in and support the business. We do expect that government will come in and support the family so that they can put food on the table. We don't expect the government to bail out the fish and chip shop. And, of course, the problem is if the government does bail out the fish and chip shop that's struggling, we don't wind up seeing a new business go in and use those resources more productively. And I think that's the real argument about why government shouldn't be supporting these farms. And, indeed, the Productivity Commission found there were a number of farmers who were brave enough to say, look, we would be much better off in the long run if we said, if you can't make your farm work through drought, and drought in Australia is entirely predictable, then you shouldn't be running a farm.
But it's not as black and white as that, is it? We've seen throughout history that our government support various industries, whether that's bailing out banks or the car industry, because for one reason or another, we value them.
Well, I think what happens is that we value them because there's a big emotional tie. We value them because they wind up as very powerful lobby groups. But as we've just seen, an Australian government prepared to say, pouring more and more money into the car industry doesn't make any sense. In the long run, it just makes other Australians poorer. And I think the same argument applies for farming. I absolutely understand why my taxes should go to ensuring that farm families can put food on the table. I don't see why my taxes should go to ensuring that their business kind of survives for another year. If I set up a business, I don't expect government to pay for me, and I certainly don't expect your taxes to pay for it.
We've got a tweet come in here from George Barnes saying, good farmer, bad farmer, you need rain before you can sort the chaff from the hay.
Well, actually, I'd say you need drought before you can sort the chaff from the hay. Anybody should be able to make money on a farm if it's raining and the conditions are perfect. But a farm business, by definition, is a business that has to last through the drought cycle, and therefore it's a business that should be able to survive. Probably won't make that much money at the height of a drought, but it should, over the, say, decade-long cycle, be able to make a way as a business.
Except that it's a cyclical sector and prepare accordingly. That's your argument, yeah?
We expect that insurance companies will survive through the insurance cycle. We expect that banks will survive through the banking cycle. If you're not strong enough to support the volatility, then you really shouldn't be running that business. It's an entirely predictable feature of Australia that we will have 3-4 year droughts.
John Daly from the Grattan Institute there. Barry Hughes is still with me from the Gulf Cattlemen's Association. Barry, what do you make of that argument?
Oh, I don't make much of that argument whatsoever. Cameron, I think, when you trace this drought back and then go back to my earlier comment where there's been a number of other impacts or issues that have impacted the way that this drought has played out. And if you look back to 2011, based on a government decision to wipe out a marketing opportunity for the northern beef industry, we've seen a 54% decline in net asset value from that time on, from $6 million down to $3 million. There's been a 28% decline in property values, and there's been a 22% increase in the debt burden that people are borrowing to get themselves through. So this government assistance issue is not about bailing farmers out. It's about giving farmers the opportunity to trade their way out of a situation that in most cases they've got no control over. The part of John Daly's comments that I refute strongly is that droughts are predictable. I just don't agree with that comment whatsoever.
I think the point is you may not know when they're coming, but you know they will come.
Yes, and droughts come in all shapes and sizes. And the length of time that you are in a drought is something that you don't have any control over. So you can be the best farmer in the world, have the best drought policies in place in your management strategies, and they can fall over at any time given the length of the drought. So I don't agree with that comment
but
whatsoever.
But Barry, the argument is that every industry and every sector has its challenges, and yet other industries don't benefit from taxpayer funds to help get them through. What's different about farming?
Well, the difference with farming is that the farming sector pays their assistance loans back, and that is something that sets us apart. We borrow this money at a concessional rate from the government, given the adversity that's facing the industry, but it comes with conditions, and those conditions are that you've got to pay that money back. So whilst it's a short-term hand up, it's not a handout.
You've been hearing there from Barry Hughes from the Gulf Cattlemen's Association. I've also been chatting with Mick Keogh, the Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute, and John Daly from the Grattan Institute on Bush Telegraph. We're talking about support for farmers, particularly when things are tough, when they're in drought. What level of government support is appropriate? How much should just come down to the individual business to get through? Professor Linda Bottrell is an expert on drought policy at the University of Canberra. Linda, thank you for sitting patiently there. Appreciate it. You've investigated what type of assistance is appropriate extensively in the past. What is the right level of help?
Well, first of all, I would have to join Barry in disagreeing with some of John Daly's analysis. I think the argument that no support be offered to farmers during drought is politically impossible. I'm reminded of the line in Yes Minister about that's a courageous decision, Minister, because I think the Australian community as a whole has a broad cultural and social sympathy for farmers, which would not allow governments to introduce a policy that said you're on your own during drought. So that means that from both an economic and policy perspective, we are always going to be looking at second best policy in economic terms, but something that provides support to farm businesses as they need it. Now, as I've said on this program before, I've been working for a long time with Professor Bruce Chapman at the Australian National University on what we believe is a very good way of balancing the sorts of concerns John's raised about the cost to the taxpayer of drought relief, but also the points that Barry makes about the financial pressures on farmers and the need for support during drought. Mm-hmm. What we're suggesting is that really what we need in agriculture are some forms of income smoothing mechanisms, because it's the income drought that's the problem. And related to this is, and it came out of your story about the family impacted by floods as well, that it's not just drought that impacts on farm businesses. So if we have effective income smoothing mechanisms that farmers can access, they can access it whatever the cause of their income difficulties, not just drought. We already have farm management deposits, which do a part of the job, but of course they are only useful if you've had time to accumulate the reserves, and they don't help new entrants to the industry. What Bruce and I have been proposing is an income contingent loan, which allows farmers access to resources when they need it during an income downturn, but which is then repaid to the taxpayer on the basis of capacity to pay. Now, the important thing about an income contingent loan is that you don't end up with farm losses and farm foreclosures, because the repayment is based on capacity to pay.
So could I compare that to a HEX repayment with your university?
That's a very broad comparison in the sense that both of them are contingent loans. Mm. But in order for a loan like this to work for the farm sector, obviously it would be structured quite differently from the way the HECS scheme is structured for higher education.
Mm-hmm. How close are we to that kind of government response, given that over the last... since we've had a government in this country, but over the last couple of decades, this argument's been going, there's been reviews, and yet we still seem to have a very similar policy response than we had a long time ago, 20 years ago.
Well, that's actually a good point, and it goes back further than that. The concessional loan scheme that Barry mentioned is almost a photocopy of the Loan Farmers Debt Adjustment Act of 1935. So what's missing from drought policy thinking in Australia, I think, is imagination. Policy hasn't really changed much in the 15 years that Bush Telly's been on the air, in the sense that it's still subject to ongoing change and uncertainty. What we need is some clear and new thinking about some drought policy that can be put in place and guarantee both farmers and taxpayers some certainty about what's available and under what circumstances.
Why would you draw the line at offering this kind of support to farmers and not extend it to rural businesses whose fortunes are tied to the well-being of the farmers?
Well, there's no reason why an income contingent loan scheme couldn't be extended to farm-dependent rural businesses. The beauty of an income contingent loan is that it is a loan that is repaid. And that means that the taxpayer can afford to be generous at the time when people need the support because they know that they're going to get a large proportion of it back through the tax system.
John Daly, you don't look like you agree with this proposition. What's wrong with it?
Well, the issue is that income contingent loans won't necessarily be repaid. And the problem is, and it's a tough political problem, as was pointed out, farmers who are unable to make their farm pay, as it were, through the cycle, are farmers who ultimately should be selling their farm to someone who one way or another can make it work. Because as I said, we can see very clearly from the Productivity Commission's analysis that even in drought-affected areas, there are farmers who make it work and farmers who don't. And from an economic perspective, you don't want people running a business if they're not very good at running it as somebody else who could do it in a better way. And so I think one of the concerns with income contingent loans is that they just become a way of putting off the evil day. Inherently, they go to the people who are struggling most. And although obviously that's an emotionally really difficult situation, you can understand why there is enormous political pressure to help the farmers who are in trouble. Actually, they're the ones who, you know, an ideal policy response would be one that one way or another encouraged them to sell the farm to someone who can make it work through the drought cycle. And I'd come back to the point that was made earlier, of course, you don't know exactly how long a drought will go on. You don't know when it will start. But you can look at the weather records for Australia and say, you know, over a 15, 20-year period, you are almost certain to have a drought, and there's a pretty good chance that it will be a drought that lasts several years, depending, obviously, on exactly where you are. Maybe the one thing that I would suggest, though, is government action that's unpredictable is different. So obviously the government ban on live trade to Indonesia is a very different story. That is something that government did in a way that was unpredictable, in a way that farmers couldn't have seen it coming. And given that government effectively caused the damage, the argument that government should essentially be paying to put farmers back, you know, to repay some of that damage is a very strong.
So you argument. Isolate that.
I think that is a different story.
Mick Kerr from the Australian Farm Institute. If I can come back to you, what do you make of the arguments, the basic arguments that either, as John puts forward, you let the strongest survive and the rest fall off the perch, or Linda Bottrell's argument that perhaps income contingent loans would be a better approach?
Look, I think my preference in terms of the business side of things is to let individual farmers manage their situations from an individual perspective. And I think it's the insurance issue is the one thing where there's a major market failing in Australia, and I think there is some work we could do there. When you look internationally, most nations have multi-peril insurance schemes of one form or another. Now, the ones that are there are usually heavily subsidised by government, but their approach is, well, you take out this insurance. If you don't, that's your choice, but you bear the consequences. And I think we have a bit of a market failure in Australia in that those insurance policies are in their fledgling state at the moment, but because the take-up is relatively low, the premium cost is very high, above 10% of insured value at the moment, and it's just not viable. But I think if we could adopt an approach a bit more like what we do with superannuation, and for example say, all right, we'll give an increased tax deductibility for the premium costs of those types of multi-peril insurance policies, then we would have a better environment where farmers can manage risk. Because the biggest issue in Australia, and that gets overlooked in all this, is that the volatility of returns in the agriculture sector are more than twice the average volatility of all the market sectors in the Australian economy. So, and also the most volatile of any agriculture sector in the world. So, is it
that volatility that you argue is why agriculture should be treated as a special case, not any kind of social attachment to farming?
Not as a special case in a sense that, I guess the issue is there that the market failure is there in that there's not readily accessible tools available for farmers to manage those risks. The result is the only way you can fund farm businesses is through pure debt, because the volatility is so high that if you try and separate the operation of a farm from the ownership of the capital base, you create a very high level of risk amongst the operator of the farm. So,
Mick, under the insurance system you propose there, would you basically treat drought the same as hail or frost or flood? Anything that destroys a crop or the business of a farming enterprise would have some level of protection?
That's what a multi-peril insurance scheme looks like.
But isn't John Daly's argument that drought is entirely predictable and therefore not a disaster like the other events?
It is, but it imposes the lack of ability to ensure that in a financially efficient way imposes quite substantial costs on the sector, because of what it means is that farmers have to maintain very high levels of equity and lock up a lot of capital just to be able to manage that. And that means they can't invest some of that capital in capital improvements to improve the efficiency of their farm. And just as we say to people in the wider society, we're going to give you a big incentive to put money away for your retirement through the superannuation system, because we know that you're going to need and face the risk of income dependency during that retirement period. So I think there's an argument there that says, well, righto, to a farm business, you're in the most volatile sector of this economy and in the most volatile agriculture sector in the world. We are going to take some measures that provide better incentives and better allow the development of decent markets for that risk. And that'll allow you to financially manage that better on your own, rather than having the taxpayer necessarily have to support each time.
Barry Hughes, what do you make of such a proposal?
Look, Cameron, I agree with the insurance side of things, and I'd like to take that that issue a step further in terms of the ability to use an insurance type system when banks are in mediation with distressed assets in the grazing and farming industry. And I think this is something that needs to be talked about a lot more, and that is for an insurance pool to be set up to allow people to access that, because of the lack of cash flow coming out of that distressed asset, to give them the best opportunity to deal with the banks in the mediation / foreclosure process. And through legal aid, where we've only got one legal aid representative right across Queensland in this situation, where we've got properties being foreclosed on a daily basis, then I see the insurance side of things, which is a little bit different, I know, to what Mick's talking about, but part of the bigger picture.
John Daly, what's your take on the insurance argument?
Look, I think the insurance argument's a very good one. And, of course, actually insurers are in the business of insuring predictable risks. That's exactly what they do. And they say, look, we know that your home won't burn down every year, but we know that on average your home will burn down once every 200 years, and therefore, you know, you'll pay a premium accordingly. And I think that the argument effectively that you should be able to buy drought insurance makes complete sense. I think that the advantage of it too is that you are encouraging farms to, as it were, put the money up front, and you're essentially getting visibility so that you can see after we've allocated out the cost of things not going right next year, you are in fact making a profit in this current good year. Mm. I suspect that the reality is that insurance will be quite expensive, and in a sense it should be expensive, because the chances of getting a drought are quite high, and the cost of it is very high, and therefore the cost of it, as it were, for the good year is quite high. I think the problem is, if you then use that as a solution for the farms that are already in trouble, it's no real solution at all. It's a good solution for figuring out which farms are in fact viable in the good years. Once you get to the bad years, you already know which farms are not viable in the long run.
And this is what seems to happen in the political cycle. When things are good, the climate is good, we don't necessarily make the plans for when things are bad, which is probably where I'd like to bring you back in, Linda. Just finally, Linda Bottrell, if I could. You talked about the politics of this and governments earlier. would any government, either side of politics, would they have the stomach to make the type of big changes that we're talking about today? Whichever the nature of changes being, whether that's John's suggestion, yours, or Mick's?
Well, I think they're very. First of all, John referred to the ideal policy response, and in the real world, we don't get ideal policy responses. For all its flaws, we live in a democracy, and people vote for politicians, expecting them to implement what they value. And for a lot of historical reasons, going back to Aristotle, people in Western democracies and Western communities value farming for a whole lot of reasons that go beyond its contribution to our economy. So governments are, however ideal from an economic point of view, the solution is not to support farmers when there's a drought and to provide them with perhaps subsidised insurance. When there is a drought, there will be considerable community pressure for the government to act in some form. If you have an insurance scheme, there will be people who are uninsured, and they will be on television, and they will be a topic of a conversation, and they will be the subject of community pressure for government to step in and support those who haven't insured themselves adequately. And we see that when there's other forms of disasters like bushfires and floods, governments come in and they act. So I don't think we can take the politics out of this. And quite honestly, as somebody who lives in a democracy, I don't see that's necessarily a problem. But I think it means that we have to be realistic when we're making policy suggestions about what's actually achievable. So I think governments need to be thinking a little bit more creatively. I think recycling a 1935 Concessional Loans Act in 2013 probably wasn't the best way forward. I think the farm management deposits have proved a nice compromise between giving farmers the capacity to risk manage and at the same time respond to the community's desire that we assist farmers when they're in difficulty.
Mm. Linda, I share your optimism on the creativity of governments, but perhaps we'll leave it there. Look, if we were going to delve into why society values farming the way it does, we'd need to be commissioned for another year. We haven't got that, so let's wrap it up there, shall we? Thanks very much, Linda. Always been nice to chat with you throughout the life of the program. All the best.
Thank you.
Professor Linda Bottrell, who's an expert on drought policy at the University of Canberra. Mick, thanks for coming in. Been great to have your contribution over the years as well. Mick Keogh, Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute. Barry, thanks for joining us. All the best.
Thanks, Cameron.
Barry Hughes from the Gulf Cattlemen's Association. And John Daly, thank you for coming in again today. Appreciate your contribution to Bush Telegraph over our time.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
John Daly is the Chief Executive Officer of the Grattan Institute. You're listening to Bush Telegraph.